Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It is Five Pillars Week on The Brian Lehrer Show, as we begin a five-part series on of interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam, which get special focus during this holy month of Ramadan. Now, as I said, this will be an interfaith call-in on the five pillars, which for the most part have universal implications, just as the Ten Commandments are principles that apply not only to Jews. The five pillars are faith in one God, prayer, fasting, charity, and pilgrimage. And we'll begin today with prayer and open the phones now for Muslims and others on the question, what is the role of prayer in your religious life? I wonder how different the responses will be from people of different faiths. What is the role of prayer in your religious life? Call us, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And because this is a Ramadan and Five Pillars series, we will reserve half our lines for Muslims, 212-433-WNYC. But beyond that, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, Unitarians, do you Unitarians pray? Anyone, how do you pray? And what is the role of prayer in your religion? 212-433-9692. Do you pray for concrete things, like to get better from your illness, or to win your baseball game that day? I always see the ball players on both teams praying. Do they think God is a Met or a Yankee or a Baltimore Oriole? 212-433-9692. Or is your prayer more abstract than that? Like you pray as an act of devotion to God, of surrender to God, something like that, instead of praying for your individual wants and needs. 212-433-9692. And how about you meditators out there, lastly? Maybe you're a secular pantheist agnostic meditator. Ha, I've got your number, don't I? Some of you. I know we have secular pantheist agnostic meditators in the New York Public Radio and New Jersey Public Radio audience. When you meditate, is it different from prayer? Are you meditating for your own well-being, to relax and lower your blood pressure and improve your concentration, self-help meditation? Or do you also meditate to connect you to something larger? And is it different from prayer? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and we'll take your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we kick off a five-part series this week of interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam, which get special focus during this holy month of Ramadan. Today, the pillar of prayer, and we're asking people who are Muslim or of any religion, how do you pray and what is the role of prayer in your religion? I wonder if we're going to get different kinds of responses. Masood in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thanks a lot for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
Go ahead and talk about prayer in your life, prayer as you understand it in your religion.
Well, I'd like to say out of the five pillars, prayer for me, and I think for a lot of others, is probably one of the hardest pillars, only because it's something that has to be done five times a day. It requires a washing before each prayer, and you know, sometimes it could get to a point where you find yourself procrastinating and not really doing all five.
So in Islam, more than other religions, it's a demanding discipline that has to be woven into your lifestyle. And what do you think the message of that is? What's the lesson of that? Whether you succeed five times every day or not, what's the lesson in the attempt?
I think the lesson is the fact that you are attempting and you are trying to pursue the prayer throughout your day, and it's also a lesson in that even if you do miss one, two, or all five months at a time, you know there's the understanding that it's forgiving and that you're always you can always come back to it any time in your life.
Masood, thank you very much for starting us off. I appreciate it a lot. Ibrahim in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ibrahim.
Brian, this is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. How are you?
Hi, long time no speak.
So for me, prayer relates to the five times of the day as a Muslim. It's really nice that it relates to the sort of the movement of the planet with the sun and the moon and the stars. So I think for me, it really orients. It's like a pillars throughout my day that ground me, that I'm part of this sort of celestial process and a celestial thing. And so it's less about me asking God for stuff. It's more about me getting centered and grounded and oriented. And it's almost like I'm at optimal level when I pray the most, and I pray consistently.
What do you pray for or about? Like, what's the content of your prayers?
I think for me, it's mostly that I don't continue to make stupid mistakes. Sometimes I, you know, like character mistakes or things, and also that my intentions are clear. I think my most basic prayer is that God sort of purifies my intentions, and hopefully, and in Islam we say that every deed begins with your intention. So if my intentions are pure, then hopefully it will help purify my actions.
Do you do the movements? Because I think that they're the movements that are supposed to go with the Muslim prayers are intended to reflect exactly what you were just describing. It's standing, bowing, prostrating, and sitting, and all, I think, to express a kind of humility, a kind of submission to God's will, and, you know, an attempt to improve your own behavior.
It's true. When Malcolm, in Malcolm X's book, like in his autobiography, when he described the first time he prayed, he described the physical bending of his knees as one of the hardest things he had to do. And I think, as for people who believe in one God, there's lots of other gods to believe in, money and fame and whatever else is that's out there. Yeah. So actually the physical movement is actually a really profound moment that you enjoy. That's why when you see older people that can't get down, up and down, they feel a little bit saddened by it, because that's what they've been so used to.
Ibrahim, thanks so much for checking in. Dina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dina.
Shalom. I pray every day so that I can connect to the source, to the Almighty, to learn what my mission in the world is. We, each and every one of us, have a mission to make this world complete. And, for example, tonight is Tisha B'Av, where we fast. The Jews fast for 25 hours. This was due to the breaching of the temple thousands of years ago. Yep. And it's a way to connect to the Almighty, to the Creator, to learn how we can make this world a better place. I think it's wonderful.
I think it's the only day other than Yom Kippur that there's kind of a mandatory Jewish fast. Am I wrong?
No, there are a few other fasts throughout the year, but I think there are four, like, 25-hour fasts.
Uh-huh.
And we have, like, a shorter fast. But this is like Yom Kippur, exactly. And we start tonight. And, in fact, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, which is the oldest synagogue in America, has a service, which I highly recommend you coming to see. It's amazing. All the lights are dim. We sit with candles. And we really get into the prayer, the tefillah, and try to connect and try to become better human beings. It's beautiful.
And
it's
really so wonderful. You're reflecting something very similar to Ibrahim, praying not just for something you want, but to become better human beings and for God to show you how to become a better human being, as you put it. You know, this may be too obscure a question, but I was thinking about the five pillars this weekend compared to the Ten Commandments, and there's certainly some overlap. But in the Jewish Ten Commandments, prayer is not actually one of them. Do you think?
Oh, yes, it is.
Which?
100%. Prayer is, well, it's in the 13 attributes, which is part of the Ten Commandments, which break into the 613 mitzvot, which is very complicated. A rabbi could probably explain it better than I.
Yeah.
But no, but to feel a prayer is, we pray. Jewish, well, the men have to pray three times. I mean, everyone's supposed to pray three times a day, but for women, because of our responsibilities with the home, we have to pray two times a day.
Uh-huh.
The Amidah, the silent devotion prayer to God. And I work on that diligently every day. I try to do two. I definitely do the one in the morning,
mm-hmm.
when I get up in the morning. But the men have to be in the synagogue very early in the morning every day, and they pray three times a day.
So for the Orthodox, who are very observant, something analogous with what we think of as the Muslim five times a day, people don't generally think of multiple times a day of prayer being woven into Judaism, at least not these days. But for the very observant, Dina, as you're reflecting, it is also there. Dina, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. And Asia in Bedford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Asia.
Hi. So
for me, I'm a Christian, and while I don't pray every day and or don't have a specific routine as, you know, some of the other people of different mm-hmm. faiths, you know, may pray. For me, prayer is about not so much asking for something in particular, but more an idea of surrendering to and asking for guidance and asking for the ability to be the best I can be, to help me in those areas of my life where I may be falling short mm-hmm. or, you know, just for me, it's about that kind of meditative, you know, prayer and wanting to just kind of tap into or plug into that sort of, you know, that power that helps me to you know, go through every day in the best possible way that I can.
Asia, thank you. And again, so similar to what we heard from the other callers, the Jewish and the Muslim callers, regarding praying to make you better, to give you better judgment. Misbah in Queens, you're on WNYC. Did I say your name right, Misbah?
Yes, yes, you said it correctly. Thank you, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you.
And also, thank you for the timely program.
Thank you.
The prayer, which, as you or someone mentioned earlier, is the first pillar of Islam. If I could divide your question into two different answers.
I think, by the way, isn't the first pillar technically the faith, to have faith in the one God, and prayer comes after that? We're going to do the faith, by the way, tomorrow with a special guest, Reza Aslan. But, yes, we've got about 45 seconds. You're going to be the last caller in this segment, so get in as much as you can.
Yes, it's a second pillar. I apologize. Yes, it is two parts, if you will. Islam, as you know, is the most strictly monotheistic religion. So whatever you need, first of all, when you pray five times, you're acknowledging the sovereignty of the Creator, who we call as Allah. And then after that, you can ask, once you pray that, you're acknowledging His complete sovereignty. And it is, you can also say that it's a one-time, one-stop shopping, if you will, whether you're asking for health for your parents, whether you're asking for children, all you need to do is just bow down before Allah and ask Him for it. As long as it is a legitimate prayer, meaning mm-hmm. like you cannot ask to help if you're going to go rob someone, you cannot ask that kind of prayer.
And Misbah, we're going to leave it there. And we thank all of you who reflected on prayer in this first of our five interfaith call-ins this week, built on the five pillars of Islam. And we will continue tomorrow on the pillar of faith. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It is Five Pillars Week on The Brian Lehrer Show. Interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam during this month of Ramadan. Today, the concept of one God and that Muhammad is God's messenger. Our special guest for this is Reza Aslan, who wrote a book about Islam called No God But God. He has a new book called Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. So we'll talk Jesus, Muhammad, gods, and prophets, and we'll take your calls on why monotheism and why prophets. 212-433-WNYC. How's this for a topic to follow the dysfunctional Congress? 212-433-9692. Or you can post to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Reza Aslan, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. I love doing this show.
Thanks. And just some background on you first. You come from Iran originally. You've been through Christianity and Sufi Islam among your personal mm-hmm. beliefs. Are you practicing anything today?
Yeah, I mean, I am definitely a Muslim, and Sufism is the tradition within Islam that I most closely adhere to, yes.
Some people call that the hippie branch of Islam.
The hippie branch.
How accurate would that be?
Well, there is certainly some hippiness to it, but that's true of all the sort of mystical branches of religions in Judaism, Christianity, Islam. The mystics are people who want to break through the shell of religion and to have an intimate union with God. And they tend to be a little less, you know, adherent to all the rules and regulations that they believe have been put together by people, you know, in these institutions. And so, yeah, sure, hippie, I'll take hippie.
So the Sufis and the Jews who read Kabbalah, and
that's right.
There you go. What do you find important about being a scholar of both Islam and Christianity, since we're in this interfaith series? Before we even get into the details of your books or go to our callers on these concepts, what do you hope to add to the knowledge or the outlook of the world with your interfaith body of work?
Well, I'm a scholar of religions. My expertise is in what's called the Western religions or the Abrahamic religions. And so
Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all three of them.
Yes, and then certainly the Near Eastern and Mesopotamian religious traditions out of which these three religions arose. And I think the reason that I do this is because what I always found fascinating as both a scholar and a person of faith is the remarkable ways in which these, throughout thousands of years and people separated by thousands of miles, have managed to come up with the same stories to describe the human condition, that not only have they asked the same questions, but they've come up with the same answers. And there's many ways to look at this. A lot of scholars would say, well, it's just that, you know, it's part of the human condition, that they are – it's an anthropological or a sociological phenomenon. But I think it's also equally legitimate to say that maybe the reason that all these people, despite their separate religious traditions, have come up with the same kinds of answers is because, you know, that the God that they are searching for is the same God. And that's what I believe.
So on that same God, why monotheism? Is it a means of control? Why not the Greek god of love and god of knowledge and god of war? Is there a historical reason for digging in on one god as the only acceptable or even civilized way?
What's fascinating is that in the 100,000-year history of religiosity, monotheism is an extremely new phenomenon. It is at most about 3,000 years old. And it repeatedly failed. Probably the first monotheist is the great Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten, the first sort of institutional monotheist who tried to create a monotheistic system sometime around the 18th dynasty, the 18th Egyptian dynasty. It failed. It failed miserably. When he died, his religious traditions, his monotheistic tradition died with him. I'd say maybe the second real monotheist is Zarathustra, the great sort of Persian prophet who was the bearer of the religion of Zoroastrianism, which is still a religion that's followed by about 250,000 people around the world, also failed miserably. When he died, his conception of monotheism became more a dualism. A lot of people think that Abraham was a monotheist, that it's actually not the case that Abraham was a monotheist. Abraham was very likely what's called a henotheist. He believed that his God was the best God, the highest God, but he didn't deny the existence of other gods. And I think the reason for it is that for the ancient minds, the idea that one God was responsible for both good and bad, darkness and light, was hard to comprehend. And so it took a very long time for it to finally catch on as a movement. And when it did catch on, you automatically see the problems with it, because the truth of the matter is that if you believe that there's only one God, then it's very likely that you believe that there's only one path to that God, that there's only one truth, which makes that anybody who disagrees with you is not just wrong but evil, satanic.
So I'm struck by the fact that the first of the five pillars of Islam, no God but God, is the same as the first of the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. Do you think it's a coincidence?
It's not a coincidence. It's actually, I mean, if you understand where Islam arose, it's deeply a part of the Judeo-Christian biblical tradition. I mean, the Prophet Muhammad never claimed to have created a new religion. He over
Neither
and over
Jesus,
again.
Right?
That's right. Over and over again, he said that this is the same religion that was given to all the prophets of the Bible, including Jesus. This is, by the way, you're right. This is true of all prophets. We have this tendency to think that prophets are inventors of religion. Prophets don't create religions. Jesus didn't create Christianity. The Buddha didn't create Buddhism. Muhammad didn't create Islam. These are reformers who reform the religious traditions of the world in which they live in. It's usually the prophet's followers who are tasked with this Herculean job of trying to figure out how to make sense of the words and the deeds of the prophet and turn it into an institutional traditional religion, which is, by the way, why so many religions are so far today from the values preached by the people that they believe that the religion was founded upon.
Reza Aslan with us. You may know him from his earlier book, No God But God, about Islam. His new book is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. And listeners, this is also an interfaith call-in based on the five pillars of Islam. In this holy month of Ramadan, we're doing one of the five pillars each day this week. And as with yesterday's call-in on prayer, we will save about half our lines for Muslims and half our lines for people from other religions. And the question today is, why monotheism? So far, our only caller is calling to bash monotheism. So monotheists, chime in here. Why is it so important to you, if you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew, that you believe in one God? Why not many gods like the Greeks or Romans who have the God of love and the God of knowledge and the God of war? It's very poetic. It's very romantic. Mm-hmm. Makes for good myths. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And why do you care about the singularly holy prophet? Why Jesus versus Muhammad or the Buddha or whoever? Do we need these figures to make our religious lives whole? Why is it for you? Muslims, what is it about Muhammad? Christians, what is it about Jesus? I know this could fill a year's worth of shows. But in a nutshell, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Reza, when you call Jesus a zealot, the title of your book, is that a compliment or an insult?
Well, it certainly has some negative connotations in our sort of modern parlance. But the zealots were a group of deeply nationalistic, pious Jews in first century Palestine who adhered to the biblical principle of zeal, which meant that they refused to acknowledge any sovereign but God. They wanted to cleanse the Holy Land of the Roman abomination. This was a time in which the Romans occupied the Holy Land. And they wanted to return it to the principles founded upon in the Torah, the concept that this land shall be for none but Jews. And eventually, these zealots would come together in the year 66 CE, or AD as some people know it, and manage to actually revolt, to rise up against the Roman Empire, kick the Romans out, hold them at bay for about 3 or 4 years before the Romans returned and destroyed Jerusalem and slaughtered the Jews and exiled the survivors. The argument that the book makes is that Jesus shared these zealot tendencies. Not all zealots were fanatics, not all of them were violent, but they all believed that the land had to be purged both of the Roman abomination, the pagans who occupied it, and of the rapacious high priest who was an occupation of the temple. If you look at Jesus' teachings in the Bible, if you look at his actions and you see them through the lens of the history in which he lived, you can see that he himself was a deeply zealous character who had these zealot ideologies.
If you would characterize Jesus first as a zealot, how would you characterize Muhammad in his time?
Well, Muhammad didn't live in a time in which his land was under occupation. He lived in a time in which the land was essentially more or less controlled by this polytheistic super tribe.
And this is Mecca 500 years later.
That's right. So this is exactly. So this is about 6th, 7th/7th century Arabia. And so as a monotheist, he certainly wanted to cleanse the land of its polytheistic traditions. And so he definitely has shared some of those zealot tendencies. The difference, of course, is that Muhammad was not what we could call a nationalist in the way that we could call Jesus a nationalist. Jesus believed in the biblical principle that the Holy Land belonged to none but the Jews, that it was given to God's chosen people, and that any other foreign presence on the Holy Land was an abomination to God. And so he wanted to cleanse it of the foreign pagan presence. Muhammad wanted to cleanse it of polytheism and rededicate it to the one God, the God of the Hebrew Bible, the God of the Quran. So they certainly had that in common with each other.
Let's take some phone calls. Michael in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you want to say?
Well, I heard the author on another program, and I think he made a distinction that I thought was interesting, that the fact of the matter is that when we look at the Trinity from a theological perspective, from a Christian perspective, he was saying that Christianity, I believe the other day, is this view. Of course, we do believe that Jesus is God in human flesh, right? And so we would believe that. But we look at the Trinity as one essence. One times one times one equals one. You can't, some people use it as water, ice, and steam, or they say it as the egg is white on the outside. You can't, the best essence, the best, the thing of the hypostatic union.
But my question to you, Michael, is why is that so important to you? That one times one equals one. Why do you have to come up with one?
Because of the fact of the matter is, if you attack the deity of Jesus Christ, right, then you attack the whole foundation of Christianity, if you attack that foundation. And that's exactly what this author's doing. I mean, he's attacking the foundation of the belief system of the entire view of Christianity. It stems out of Judaism. It comes out of, and if you follow the gospel in an accurate sense, you follow it. It's basically that Jesus came, he was chosen to come through those people, and then through the Jews, and then to be brought out to the entire world. And this is the gospel.
All right, Michael, hang on. And so, Reza, is that what you think you're doing?
Well, I think that's a perfectly valid interpretation of the gospels. My wife is a Christian. My mother is a Christian. I would by no means say that I am attacking Christianity in any way whatsoever. But I'm interested in Jesus the person. I mean, whatever else Jesus was, if he was God or if he was Messiah, he was also a person. And as a person, he lived in a specific time. And while it is certainly true that the foundation of Christianity is the Trinity, which, by the way, is a theological doctrine that was embedded into Christianity around the 4th century, so more than 300 years after Jesus died. That doesn't make it any less valid, but nevertheless, I think that is an important historical viewpoint. The important thing to understand, however, is that Jesus was a Jew, that the only religion that he knew was the religion of Judaism, that the only scriptures that he was familiar with was the Hebrew Bible. The only God that he communed with was the God of the Hebrew Bible. And Judaism, the Hebrew scriptures, the world in which Jesus lived, had no conception of a God-man. The idea of a divine human being is anathema to 5,000 years of Jewish thought, tradition, scripture, conception.
So what was he after? Was it the worldly overthrow of the Roman Empire, which I think is what he got crucified for allegedly believing in?
That's exactly what he got crucified for. Again, I think readers must remember that the only crime for which one could be crucified under Roman dominion is the crime of sedition, the crime of treason. People always talk about the thieves who were crucified next to him. Again, you have to remember.
But in your historical telling, was that what he was after? Was it something more, mystical, religiously revelatory?
Well, I think in first century Palestine, there wasn't a difference between religion and politics, that it was his religious ideology as a Jew to cleanse the Holy Land for the Jews that then brought him to conflict with the Roman military occupation and resulted in his death as a state criminal.
Ilya in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I wanted to make two points. You had asked, you know, why is monotheism important? So I'm Jewish, very much enjoying your guest. And I think you asked why not a god of beauty, a god of, you know, fertility, all these other gods. And I think if you believe in monotheism, you don't need other gods. You believe that your one greater being is responsible for everything.
But why is that better? Because one could say, well, if I have all those other gods, the god of war, the god of beauty, and the god of knowledge, then I don't need to think there's one unified, omnipotent something.
I think looking at it as better or worse is maybe not the framework. I think it's just, if you believe in monotheism, it's not necessary. You know, mm-hmm. It almost doesn't make any sense because you believe there's one creator. So that one creator creates all of these other things. I also just wanted to comment, you're talking about a lot of similarities. Many of your Jewish listeners are probably fasting today for
Tisha B'Av,
which is just, you know, as your Ramadan listeners are fasting as well.
Indeed. So you could all get together and have a feast at sundown tonight. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing, a Jewish Muslim.
Oh, it happens.
Tisha B'Av,
it happens all around this country.
Ramadan feast.
A lot of great Muslim Jewish communions in this
tonight
country.
Tonight around 8:30. Misbah in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hello, Misbah. Misbah, turn your radio off, okay?
Yes. Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes. I also want to say I do plan to read The Zealot this weekend, and I did read the review, especially on Amazon.com, and I also read the article with Terry Gross, so I'm really looking forward
Good.
To it.
And you're Muslim, correct?
Yes, I am.
And so what do you think about these ideas that we've been talking about the importance of a prophet or, you know, a unitary prophet or monotheism?
I did have a few comments, if I could. First of all, I just wanted to slightly disagree with Reza on what he said about Prophet Abraham, at least from the Muslim perspective. The Quran says it differently than what Reza believes it does. Reza may be referring to the time before Abraham got his revelation and before he was appointed as a prophet. Before that, yes, he was experimenting with worshiping the moon, then worshiping the sun. Then he got turned away from him. He said, no, I'm not going to worship. But eventually he turned. He said, no, my God is a one who is mm-hmm. not going to set. And finally he did.
Okay, and what's your other point? Because we're going to run out of time.
The other point here is you asked about why Prophet Muhammad. Prophet Muhammad, because he was born in complete history. He was a husband. He was a father. He was a neighbor. He was a judge. He was a statesman. All these different aspects of his life are in front of us to look at, to analyze, and to make up our mind. And I think everyone, when they read it, they will agree that he was the perfect human being. He was a human because that's what God wanted, to show that a human can behave in a nice way.
He was also a warrior. Where does that come in for you?
He was a warrior. He was a commander. He led battles personally. And he was a judge. He judged people. He forgave people. He showed how to forgive people. He showed mercy. He showed how to deal with neighbors who were very nasty to him, who threw thorns on him.
And Misbah, I really appreciate your call. I'm going to leave it there because we're almost out of time for the segment. And Reza, your thoughts on what he said. Forget the Abraham debate for the moment.
Yeah, I'll leave that alone. No, look, this is absolutely true. One thing that's really remarkable is that the Shahada, the statement of faith, that there is no God but God, isn't just a statement of monotheism. So in other words, it's not just that there is only one God. The way that the Sufis especially understand it is that what it means is that God is in and of himself oneness. In other words, the substance of God is oneness, that's divine unity, so that God cannot be divisible, cannot be divided in any way. The dualism in Western philosophy between creator and creation doesn't exist in Islam. And again, what the Sufis say, therefore, is that if that's the case, then if you can't, then everything that exists exists because it shares in the substance of God, which means all of us, in a sense, share in the substance of God. God is one, is different than there is one God.
Can you give me 30 seconds on Muhammad as warrior? Jesus is sometimes called by his followers the Prince of Peace. Muhammad is believed to have received divine revelations and been all those things that Misbah was describing, but also as a warrior, which leads others to really suspect him and Islam. Why was that right? Or is that even the right way to ask the question?
Well, Jesus said, do not think that I have come to bring peace. I have come to bring the sword. He said that he who does not have a sword should sell his cloak and buy one.
Why?
He was executed as a state criminal for the crime of insurrection against the state. Yeah, I think a lot of that stuff has been kind of whitewashed because the Gospels were written after the Jewish revolt. And so some of that revolutionary aspect of Jesus was removed from the Gospel story. But these were men who lived in a specific time. Muhammad lived in the middle of a war. And so, of course, he took part in that war. Jesus lived in the middle of an insurrection, and he was part of that insurrection.
It is Five Pillars Week on The Brian Lehrer Show. Interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam during this month of Ramadan. There was our one on the first one, One God and the Prophet Muhammad. Tomorrow, fasting. And we thank Reza Aslan, his new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, where you are the reporters this hour, you are the analysts, you are the experts, and you are the guests. And it's Five Pillars Week on the Brian Lehrer Show, as many of you know. Interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam during this holy month of Ramadan. The five pillars are faith in one God, prayer, fasting, charity, and pilgrimage. Today we'll talk about fasting, pillar number three. And again, this is an interfaith call-in. We'll save about half our lines for Muslims and half for people from other religions. Or even if you fast just as an individual, you can call in and tell us, what is the role of fasting in your spiritual life? 212-433-WNYC. What is the role of fasting in your spiritual life? 212-433-9692. And screeners, make sure we save a few lines for Muslims since this is a Ramadan-based call-in. During Ramadan, for those of you who don't know, people are supposed to fast from sunup to sundown. So Muslims, please call in and tell everyone how you do it. Do you have a fasting ritual? Do you eat certain things at night to keep you going in the optimal way during the day? Do you pig out in the evening so you'll get less hungry during the day? Or does eating kind of lightly at night actually suit you more or make it easier? And is eating lightly at night more part of the ritual? Let us know your fasting routine. I'm sure non-Muslims especially could learn from that. 212-433-WNYC. I also wonder how much harder it is this time of year when sun up to sundown is so much of the day, right? Since Ramadan moves throughout the year, is it easier in December and January when the days are short? And what about for anyone else? Yesterday, I know, is the Jewish holiday of Tisha B'Av or Tish B'Av. Some say the ninth day of the month of Av, a day when observant Jews fast to commemorate the destruction of the temples in ancient Israel and other tragedies in Jewish history. It's the saddest day of the year in the Jewish calendar. So Jews, what role does fasting play in your spiritual life? And I was looking at a Christian website last night that called fasting one of the most powerful spiritual tools that Christians have. So Christians, you too, what role does fasting play in your spiritual life? And finally, I know secular people are independently spiritual. People also fast, sometimes for spiritual health, sometimes for physical. The New York Knicks, Carmelo Anthony, was in the news this year for trying a multi-day fast during basketball season. Were you aware of that when it was happening? That had him on a, not no food, but a limited diet for multiple days, and he called it a fast. And then I think he and his doctors concluded in that case that it was not a good idea for a professional athlete during the professional sports season that he played. But for Muslims and anyone else, what is the role of fasting in your spiritual life? And tell us about your fasting ritual. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll take your calls right after this. Pillars Week on the Brian Lehrer Show. Interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam during this holy month of Ramadan. Today, pillar number three, fasting. We have many Muslims and Christians and Jews calling up. All our lines are full right now, so hold off until people finish up at 212-433-WNYC. And let's start with Khalid in Manhattan. Khalid, thanks a lot for calling in. How you doing?
Fine, thank you. Thank you for taking my call, Brian. Fasting is a very unique form of worship in Islam because it is not apparent to anybody. It's something that you are doing and nobody can see it that you are fasting. And so I think that is the uniqueness of fasting, I guess, in any faith as compared to any other form of worship. For me personally, it has sort of reconnected me again. I've started fasting. It's about 8-9 days now. And you know, start to offer the five daily prayers, which I had been amiss. And I think that has helped in the fasting and the discipline that it brings in, the humility that it brings in, has sort of gotten me back onto that track. And because this comes once a year, so I'm hoping that this month will my pattern of practicing my faith will persist, and I will carry this through for the rest of the year.
Thank you so much for starting us off beautifully like that, Khalid. And Malik in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Malik.
Hi. I think it's there's a different meaning for fasting for Muslim. There's a spiritual connection between the Muslim and definitely Allah when you come to fulfilling what they call, you know, something. If you are able to do, you must do it. If you don't have no health excuse or no physical excuse.
What's your ritual? What do you do at night? What do you eat when you can't eat when the sun goes down?
Like every Muslim, I don't eat until sunset after the iftar. So,
right, and then are there certain things that you eat during Ramadan that help you get through the fast during the day after you eat them at night, or not really?
Yes, definitely, because there are things, you know, that come from our countries, you know, some type of meal that can help you sustain, you know, the fast for the whole month. And there's also the sense of community. We have to gather together to share this meal and to connect, between us, but to connect also, to remember the good things that, you know, we used to share back home. But the other thing is, a lot of people will tell you that are Muslim, that there's a health benefit from fasting. People might say, I'm in diet, or I don't eat this. But definitely there's a very, and medically some doctors also have talked about this thing. There's a real health benefit. And the last benefit, and the last meaning is, by fasting, you connecting or you feeling the shoe that those who do not have, you feel like those who cannot have the meal or one meal or two meal, you really feel their pain. And
so you're really connecting with the truly hungry.
Absolutely.
Malik, thank you very much. And I think that'll relate to tomorrow's pillar that we'll talk about, which is charity. But thank you. Yoshua in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that we finished the fast of Tisha B'Av. It's like 26 hours. And despite it being like an auspicious day and spiritual, it's really a miserable experience.
Is it worse on Tisha B'Av than on Yom Kippur?
Well, yeah, Yom Kippur, it's different because on Yom Kippur there's a lot of hype about how you're above eating on Yom Kippur, you're like an angel, you're beyond eating, you've moved to that next level. But on Tisha B'Av it's just we've been punished and we've been bad and now we're not allowed to eat. So. And we don't have coffee. Not having coffee is the worst. I mean, that's that's bad. Try just not having coffee for 26 hours. Eat and don't have coffee.
Just the no coughing fast, torture for Jews, says Yoshua in Brooklyn. Thank you very much. Florette in Flatbush, you're on WNYC. Hi, Florette.
Good morning, Brian, and thank you for taking my call. You know I'm a dyed-in-the-wool fan of yours.
Thank you.
And I tell you that I've been listening to you online in Mexico when I spend my winter vacations there.
Thank you so much.
I was trying to get through to you when you were talking about the bribery, and the guy in Mexico City beat me to it. Anyway, getting to the fasting, okay?
Yes.
All right. We learned to fast when we were little children, when we were preparing for Holy Communion, and I found that in my... You know, I'm 79 now. I'm going to be 80 on New Year's Day. I found in my elderly years that all of that is effective for disciplinary matters because I always fasted, you know, during Lent. Mm-hmm. We're limited to one full meal a day. And when you go to Holy Communion, you're not supposed to have anything after midnight. Now I think a lot of that has changed, but I maintained it. And when I found that there were certain, and I told my children when I was teaching, you know, there were certain things that you learn to do without, and then you find out later on with the discipline that you learn from fasting, you don't need it. I mean, I told them how I gave up this candy bar. It was chocolate with nuts. I'm not going to say the name. But I was hooked on this. And I gave it up for one Lent. And then I did without it, and I never went back. I never ate it again.
Right.
But when I developed the diabetes, when I let myself go, and I gained all the weight and everything, and I developed the type 2 diabetes.
And I think they say
the exercise, and
yes.
I did it. And I lost like 55 pounds in 18 months just from remembering the fasting, and I got rid of the type 2 diabetes.
Wow, that's great.
So, you know,
great,
disciplinary fasting can help you in disciplinary ways later on in your life.
Thank you so much, Florette. Keep listening, please. And Patty in Morris County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Brian. I'm a Mormon, and as part of our worship, we fast the first Sunday of every month for 24 hours. And I found it extremely powerful. My husband and I ran a 12-step group in our church, and we found that addicts of any type had a greater degree of recovery with fasting. And really, to overcome any personal problem, fasting was amazing.
Thank you very much. I didn't realize that Mormons fast that frequently. First Sunday of every month, is that what you said?
First Sunday of every month. Generally, you have dinner on Saturday night and then have dinner again on Sunday night. And the money that you would have spent on the two meals that you missed are given to the poor. It's called a fast offering.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Asma in Marlboro, you're on WNYC. Hello, Asma.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Ramadan Kareem to everybody first. It's a great month for us, very important. And I just wanted to add that there's a special importance of the Quran in this month, our holy book, which started to come down in this month. And we, with the fasting, we reconnected with this book this month, and we spend a lot of time reciting it, reading and trying to understand it.
And how about the fast? Does that somehow connect with your interest in the Quran this month?
Yes. I think the fasting is harder in the beginning, the few days. But as the month goes by, we actually miss it by its end. I think it spiritually strengthens me when our stomach is empty, I guess our heart is stronger. And with the Quran and the regular reading of it and reciting of it really goes hand in hand, and it helps each other.
What's your own personal practice for eating at night? Do you eat a lot at night to prepare for the next day's fast?
No. We eat dates. I think dates really help, and yogurt. Dates is also the practice of the Prophet. So I personally eat dates in the morning and when I break my fast. And then we just go on to a regular dinner. I know there are a lot of other cultural practices where people eat a lot, but I think we've cut those down and just go on a very healthy fruit and date diet, which is really helpful. And yogurt really helps.
Thank you very much for your call. And Mohammed in Somerset, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mohammed.
How are you doing?
Good, Mohammed. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Fasting is basically is twofold. It's physical and it's spiritual, and you must fast from bad behavior, must fast from, you know, not treating people well, not having good character. So the fast helps you get all that stuff into check if you're serious about fasting. The food, the absence of the food is just a physical manifestation of the spiritual application that you're supposed to utilize.
Can you focus on those higher spiritual goals if you're hungry, or do you just think during the day, I can't wait till 8:30 when I can eat?
If you've been fasting for years, you know, every year you fast, so I've probably been fasting since I was 19, so...
You mean for Ramadan?
Yes. So I'm looking at... 40 years of fasting during that month. And also you can fast on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You can do a juice fast. You can do so many different types of fasts prior to preparing yourself for Ramadan. So it's not really, hunger is not really the factor.
Don't you wish it was December, though, when Ramadan came this year, so there's only 9 hours of daylight?
Yeah, it's easier, the shorter... You know, then it's, you break your fast in a shorter fashion.
Mohammed, that's going to be the last word because we're out of time. Thanks to all of you from so many faith traditions who called in on today's installment of Five Pillars Week on The Brian Lehrer Show, these interfaith call-ins. Tomorrow it will be on the topic of charity, and I hope you'll join me then. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's Five Pillars Week on The Brian Lehrer Show. Interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam during this holy month of Ramadan. The five pillars are faith in one God, prayer, fasting, charity, and pilgrimage. And on this Thursday, we're up to pillar number four, charity. And again, folks, this is an interfaith call-in. So we'll save about half our lines for Muslims and half for people from other religions, or even if you offer charity just as an individual, you can call in and tell us, what is the role of charity in your spiritual life? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Now, in Islam, as I understand it as an outsider, there are zakah and sadaqah, Arabic words, the mandatory and voluntary giving of alms. Muslims listening right now, who wants to call in and explain to the rest of us that distinction between mandatory and voluntary charity? Where's the line? What's the qualitative difference? 212-433-WNYC. And charity, of course, is a pillar of all the major religions. In Hebrew, they call it tzedakah, charity and righteousness. And Christian charity, caritas in Latin, also sometimes translated as altruistic love. So Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, anyone else, call in with the role of charity in your religion or your spiritual life. 212-433-WNYC. And again, for our screeners, and so some of you are not insulted if you get bumped, we're going to save about half our lines for Muslims since this is a Ramadan-based call-in, but it is for everybody, 212-433-9692. You know, there are so many worthy charities in the world. How do you decide who should get your limited resources? 212-433-9692. Is there a Muslim approach to this, or a Christian, or a Jewish, or a Hindu, or any other approach? 212-433-9692. And is charity in your spiritual life just about giving money, or does it go deeper than that on a behavioral level or in any other way? It's interesting to me that the word for charity gets intertwined with these other things, in Hebrew with the word for righteousness and in Latin with the word for love. I like the word service, which I think includes monetary charity and other kinds of action. Your voluntary work is charity and service. So for me, this is where the rubber meets the road in religion. All the other pillars are more about your experience of yourself, right? Fasting. You feel pure at the end of that, but what have you done? Praying, same thing. Pilgrimage, faith. They're primarily about your inner life. And maybe they make you more humble, which is a word that has come up all week long, humble, humility. Charity is about behavior, though, towards others and making a difference out there. And I mean in all religions. You know, you can meditate by yourself on the top of a mountain for years and think you're enlightened, but you're not unless you come back down and turn it into service, are you? Charity. Or is your or your religion's idea of charity different? 212-433-9692. So call in and talk about the role of charity in your spiritual life for Five Pillars Week on The Brian Lehrer Show. Interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam observed during this holy month of Ramadan or in whatever is your religion or your individual practice. 212-433-WNYC, and we'll take your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Five Pillars Week on The Brian Lehrer Show. Interfaith call-ins based on the five pillars of Islam during the holy month of Ramadan. So you heard me lay it out for today. Before the break, the fourth pillar, charity, 212-433-WNYC. And Misbah in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I
Before I tell you the difference between zakat and sadaqah, I just wanted to say is charity is a central, very important part of Islam, because caring for your fellow human being is what Islam is all about. Yes, you have the worship. You first have to accept the sovereignty of God, but then after, and the prophets and the angels, and after that, then when it comes to human relations, charity plays the most important role. That being said, now that there's a difference between zakat, which we are talking about today, and then the non-zakat, the sadaqah part. Zakat is collected on certain things, for example, the gold that you have, the silver, the bank balance, if you are a farmer, crops, mineral deposits, cattle, etc. And there are different rates that you collect on it.
And I read that it's 2.5%. Is that right? That you're supposed to give from those things as the sort of mandatory charity from, I think, what you're describing as people's basic income sources, right?
The 2.5% is for gold, silver, bank balance. Mm-hmm. But if you happen to have, let's say, an oil well or mineral deposits, if you have crops, if you have cattle, then the rate is different. Now, once you collect the zakat can be given only in 8 different categories. For example, if you wanted to build a new mosque, you cannot give any money from your zakat contributions.
In other words, you still have to give that money to charity, like to the poor, and then to building the mosque from this other voluntary fund. Am I hearing you right?
Exactly. And also, let's say your parents are in need of money, or your children are in need of money. You cannot use the zakat funds that you have to help your parents.
Because that's your own family, so that's not considered outside charity. So fascinating, and some pretty good sounding principles the way you laid them out there. Misbah, thank you very much. To make sure that money is flowing out, not just to your worship site, a new mosque, or to your family, but in addition, flowing out of your own particular circle. That's so interesting. Diana in Manhasset, you're on WNYC. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Love the show.
Thank you.
So I wanted to make a couple of comments because we're kind of all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised Catholic. My husband of 21 years is Muslim. So one of the methods we use for decision as to how we give is ability to secure a matching grant from his employer because they have a matching grant program. I lost my job the third time in 3 years and recently because of the downturn. I'm in financial services.
Uh-huh.
But when I did have a job, I did the same thing. And when we disagree we just go for, frankly, WNYC's or PBS donation time where we wait for the
match.
Know, 2-for-1 match,
right.
and then I put it in
right.
for his.
But, you know, I mean, I don't want to make this about us. I say during those membership drives, this is a cultural institution, and I hope people give to us and to what I would consider charities, even though we're same under the charitable deduction tax laws. But, you know, I mean, I hope people who are contributing to WNYC are also giving to what I would call charity, which is,
of course,
you know,
I was just using that as an example.
So do you find that you're, with your Catholic upbringing and being married to a Muslim, that the conceptions from your traditions are essentially the same, or are there some differences in there that are worth articulating?
Right. So I have adopted the Muslim approach because it is much more you know, I don't want to cast aspersions, but it's very genuine. You know, it's all about true service. So I live in a community where I, as a walker, have been honked at because I don't walk fast enough, and this from the very same people who will go to church. It's crazy.
Diana, I'm gonna leave it there. I appreciate you sharing your experiences. And Ida and Elizabeth, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm Jewish, and I wanted to say that we're obligated by the Jewish faith to give ma'aser, or 10% of our net income. I'm a widow on a fixed income. I do the best I can. I feel charity begins at home and give to my local area, particularly if there's no cut to a collection agency. I do have money that I squirrel away that I don't use for myself, that I want my dear children and grandchildren to inherit. I don't count that in mm-hmm. this. And that's the best I can do.
Aida, thank you so much. Roxana in Holland, Pennsylvania. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was born in a Muslim family, and of course, over the years, I have moved away from all organized religion. However, I look at charity as what my mother had taught me, and it was mandatory charity was if you sleep with a full stomach and your neighbor is hungry, it is against humanity and therefore a sin in religion, and therefore it is mandatory that you help out your neighbor. However, the other charity is that if a person knocks at your door and puts his arm out to you for help, no matter who he is, whether Muslim, Christian, anybody, it doesn't matter who he is, it's a matter of humanity. And you don't have to know whether he is real or not, or whether he's just cheating you, but it is your moral and your religious and your humanity obligation to give that person.
So for yourself, with your philosophical grounding that you've so well articulated, how do you choose among all the, you know, needy people in the world? Is it just who you run into on the street? Are you looking for who you think does the most good in the developing world? Or for yourself, how do you do that?
You choose by what you think is the neediest person, even if it is not somebody that is going to make a difference in the developing world, but somebody who will reach out to one family, to one person, and lift that person out of poverty or out of that hunger or out of that darkness for one day or mm-hmm. 1 hour and save that person. That is how I have always chosen, and I have two phenomenal sons who work and everything, and I see that what my mother, who had an eighth grade education, has instilled in me, I am able to do that. And living in America where you can earn that dollar and make that difference. And that is how I choose whoever I feel is the neediest.
Roxana, thank you so, so much. Harpreet in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, how are you? Okay, I'm a Sikh, and in Sikhism, charity is one of the most prominent things, and I would say it's one of the most prominent pillars, as you say. And especially in India, where there are a lot of prominent temples, as we call them, gurudwaras, like they have a charity food, which we call langar. It goes on for 24 hours in most of the prominent gurudwaras. And the secondary gurudwaras, I would say, like the free food, which is for all the religions. Anybody can come in any time of the day and have food as much as they want. That is one part of the charity which was started like back in the 1500s when the Sikhism was born. It was founded by Guru Nanak.
So kind of physical community centers with food in that respect. All right, we have time for one more, and it's going to be Shamima in Valley Stream. You're on WNYC. Hello.
First of all, assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you.
And to you.
And I just wanted to show the difference that the zakat, the obligatory charity, is only 2.5% of what we have saved. And even with that saving, there you have to have a minimum of $4,000 or $5,000 to have to give money. And according to some opinions, you don't even have to give. If you have saved gold, you have to give only when you have acquired new gold in the year. And in the Islamic civilization, when there were Islamic rulers, it was considered obligatory tax, and it was distributed among the poor. So as opposed to what we pay, 30% income tax per year based on your income, it was so much more fair to the people at large.
And in our last 30 seconds, since this is one of the five pillars which are observed during Ramadan, I know they're observed all year round. Is there something special that you do on Ramadan for this?
definitely. In Ramadan, we find ways to give charity. We serve food to people at kitchens, and we sponsor a breaking fast ceremony at mosques and other places across the world. And we also try to give more monetary, voluntary charity, sadaqa.
During this time of year,
the blessings are multiplied.
Shamima, thank you so much. And thanks to all of you who called for what I think was another great Five Pillars Week call in. And we conclude it tomorrow with your stories of going on pilgrimages, whether to Mecca or wherever from your tradition.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Next, we open the phones for the fifth and final installment in Five Pillars Week, the Brian Lehrer Show's Ramadan Month series of interfaith conversations based on the five pillars of Islam. The five pillars are faith in one God, prayer, fasting, charity, and today's topic, the pillar of Hajj, or pilgrimage. The phones are open for your stories of pilgrimage, whether you've taken the Hajj to Mecca or have any other reflections on a spiritual pilgrimage you've taken, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692 for your stories of pilgrimage. And as we've done throughout this series, we'll reserve a few lines for Muslims, since this is a Ramadan month series based on the pillars of Islam. But it's also an interfaith call-in, and anyone can call in to talk about the role of pilgrimage in your spiritual life. Last year's Hajj fell at the end of October. If you made the trip, give us a call. This year, it's expected to fall somewhere between October 13th and 18th. If you're planning to make the trip, tell us about your plans, what you expect, what the journey means to you. And maybe we can even pair you with someone who's made the trip, share tips about what it was like. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692 for your stories of pilgrimages you've taken, pilgrimages you're planning, and what they mean for your spiritual life. And while the Hajj is a physical journey to Mecca, required once in a lifetime for all Muslims who are able-bodied and who can afford to do so, there are lots of ways to interpret the idea of pilgrimage. In Christianity, life itself is a pilgrimage, a journey towards deeper understanding and a more perfect communion with God. But of course, there are also physical places that attract pilgrims in Christianity, Judaism, and many other religions. Perhaps one of the most famous trips to Mecca from America was that trip taken by Malcolm X in 1964. Prior to his trip as a member of the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X had famously referred to white people as the devil. The trip had a profound impact on him, though, and he wrote about the experience this way. There were tens of thousands of pilgrims from all over the world. They were of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans. But we were all participating in the same ritual, displaying a spirit of unity and brotherhood that my experiences in America had led me to believe never could exist between the white and the non-white. And here's Malcolm X from a press conference upon returning to the U.S. from his pilgrimage.
Many white people will be on the side of the Negro. Many white people are fed up with what the Negro suffered. And this is what I had to become aware of on my pilgrimage to Mecca. I could see then that there are many white people in this country who will side with the Negro in whatever he has to do to protect himself.
But that's a considerable change of opinion in Malcolm X.
No, today I'm speaking for myself. Formerly, I spoke for Elijah Muhammad. And everything I said was, Elijah Muhammad teaches us thus and so. I'm speaking now from what I think, from what I have seen, from what I have analyzed, and the conclusions that I have reached.
Then the white man is no longer the devil, and he is no longer bound to be evil?
Why judge a man by his conscious behavior? I am not a racist. I don't subscribe to any of the tenets of racism.
Then there are good whites and good blacks and bad whites and blacks.
It's not a case of being good and bad, good or bad blacks and whites. It's a case of being good or bad human beings.
That's Malcolm X in 1965 talking after his pilgrimage to Mecca. We're taking your calls of pilgrimage. The phone number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. A 2008 Harvard survey of those who completed the Hajj concluded that it, quote, increases belief in equality and harmony among ethnic groups. Those who have performed the Hajj show increased belief in peace and in equality and harmony among adherents of different religions. Does this ring true for you if you completed the pilgrimage to Mecca? Give us a call. We'll be back after the break with your stories of pilgrimage, and I'll play a clip of the photographer Annie Leibovitz from this show. She was on to talk about a book of hers called Pilgrimage, trips she took to places that were important in her life. We'll hear Annie Leibovitz on pilgrimage when we come back after the break. In the meantime, call with your stories, 212-433-9692. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehr on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're taking your calls as part of Five Pillars Week. Today's topic, Hajj, or pilgrimages. As we've done all week long, we're saving some lines for Muslim callers, but this is an interfaith conversation. So if you have an experience of spiritual pilgrimage that you'd like to share, please also give us a call. The phone number, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. I want to start with Mizbah in Queens, New York. You have completed the Hajj?
Yes. Hi, Anna. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I did. I went for Hajj 12 years ago.
And what was it like?
It was really a profound experience. This is an experience that most Muslims really look forward to all their life. And when it eventually happens, you really are moved, even though you know what the rituals are, even though you know what to expect. Still, when you get there, it is a really moving experience that is very hard to describe in words.
Tell me, Mizbah, what you said you went 12 years ago. About at what point in your life was that? Were you a young adult? Were you in middle age? Or
I was about 40 years old then.
And 40 years old. So this is something you had anticipated. Just describe for us, what was it like? Did you fly from Queens to Mecca?
That is correct. I flew from JFK Airport.
You flew from JFK, and then you arrive. And just walk us through what it was like when you first arrived at the airport and then were figuring out what to do next.
We took the Royal Jordanian Airlines, so it stopped in Jordan. And that is where, before you actually arrive, there are certain points that are called as miqat, which stands for boundary. That is where you have to change into two simple white sheets of cloth. So that's what we did in Jordan. And again, if I could just speak briefly, these two sheets, these of simple white unstitched cloth, they take out all the barriers between the rich and the poor. So a billionaire could be standing right next to a pauper praying, and no one could tell the difference who is, you know, who's rich, who's poor, who's what. So it removes the ihram, removes the social class right there.
Interesting.
Yes, and I really appreciated you playing Malcolm X's autobiography a little bit and also his clip. And this is what it is when you go there for people who are not used to it. You know, Malcolm X had said after he performed the Hajj, he said, Islam has the solution to America's race problems. And that's where he saw, you know, the white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired people dipping their hands and eating from the very same plate where the dark-skinned black Africans were eating from. So every time, as you know, when you dip your hands in the same plate, some of the food will fall off of your hand that you've been eating. And they really don't mind it. And they drink from the same cup. And he saw that there was really no racism at all the way he dealt with people. So the Hajj really takes out. Not only is it a profoundly religious experience where everyone is chanting, "Here I am, O Lord, you have no partner," but it also shows you, you know, there are people from Indonesia, there are people from Africa, there are people from the Indian subcontinent, there are people from America, there are people from Canada, everywhere.
All together in Mecca.
Well, in one place.
Mizbah, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Now, Sam in Hackensack, New Jersey, you had a different kind of pilgrimage.
The first time I made a conscious decision to make a trip to Israel as an adult, when I got to the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, whatever you'd like to call it, which is basically the last remnant of the old temple, which was actually used as a place of pilgrimage in biblical times. There's a tremendous connection to the history and the culture of my people that you don't expect. I'm Jewish and I'm not a religious person, but there's a feeling, an unspeakable feeling that you kind of that takes you over when you're in a certain place.
So, Sam, you went thinking not necessarily that you were going on a spiritual pilgrimage, and then you felt this feeling of connection that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, it was really, made the decision to kind of explore the country myself, and when I got to that location and you think about what the history is, it's a deep cultural and emotional response to it rather than a true religious experience.
Sam, thank you so much for your call. Santos in Park Slope, tell us about your pilgrimage.
Well, it's for a different place altogether. It's to the Shrine of St. James at Santiago de Compostela in Galicia, Spain. It began in the first millennium AD, and it extends mostly all across the northern tier of Spain, starting in the Pyrenees, making your way practically to the Atlantic Ocean. It's about 800 kilometers, which is about 500 miles, and I did it with my wife and my son, who has special needs, last September. And it was walking between 12 and 15 miles a day up mountains and along paths and carrying a backpack. It was quite strenuous, and what it did for us, and we're not religious, but what it did for us, it really drew us together, and my son's special needs. First of all, everybody on the Camino was very accepting and thought he was just an equal, just regardless of what his special needs were. But we also became equal, my son, myself, and my wife. It was a drawing together. It was wonderful.
Santos, thank you so much for your story. This feeling of equality is an interesting theme we're hearing. Yavuz, you took the Hajj. You went to Mecca. You're in Neptune, New Jersey. Tell us about what you felt.
Well, this was a very intense experience for me and my wife. I went to Hajj 3 years ago with my wife, flew from JFK to Istanbul, and we wore the white garments, actually, in Istanbul when you start flying, because you had the intention to go to Mecca. And what really striking me was the high level of variety of different backgrounds, creed, whatever your level in the society is, whether you're the head of a country or a lay person, you're equal in the eye of God. And the most striking piece for us was you are actually playing a theater. You are sometimes becoming an Abraham, sometimes becoming a son of Abraham, Ishmael. So you have actually playing an act in Mecca, and you are doing different rituals. It's really really amazing to see all level and all different kinds of people united and just increasing their faith and bond. I was really impressed and was very emotional with my wife. We will definitely go again. And like you have beautifully mentioned what Malcolm X has done, I mean, he had a different perception and he changed totally in terms of his perspective, even though he was coming from difficulties in the society in terms of racism, he had a very different look after he went to Mecca. And that's what the humanity needs in terms of, regardless of what our background is, we need to respect first as a human to each other. That was my experience, and I truly appreciate NPR for letting us share this.
Of course. Thank you so much for your story, Yavuz. Now, Dana in Queens, you've had a spiritual pilgrimage, but you consider yourself religiously agnostic?
Agnostic to a non-deist. I think religion tends to, unfortunately, cause conflict because it's centered on power. But I went to Delphi in Greece, and stayed there the whole day. I went to just advance a little bit of myself culturally, but I ended up getting a conversion experience in a way because I realized there are some places, perhaps Mecca, perhaps Jerusalem, that are imbued with spirituality, and we can all reach that. It doesn't have to be through a particular religion or affiliation.
And tell me how you felt that. You said you weren't intending to feel that, and then what came over you?
There is something about the place not the scenery, not the people around you, but the very essence of the place that had an incredible power to move one, at least me and a few other people that I saw, if you just stilled yourself and was there to access it. It may be in all these other places. I have no idea.
Dana, thank you so much for your call. Henry, in Fort Lee, New Jersey, you also had a sort of unintentional pilgrimage?
Absolutely. I was in Israel visiting some friends in Jerusalem, and I'm not religious. I'm not observant. My family, the same. And
is your background, are you Jewish?
Jewish, yeah, but completely non-observant and non-religious. Went there with a friend who actually is a rabbi. He also came from the same kind of background but became a rabbi. And we approached the Wailing Wall from three different directions over a two-week period. And I was being led around. I didn't know where we were. And each time that I caught a glimpse of it, tears flowed overwhelmingly and spontaneously. And I had no idea that this would happen, and it was really just like out of the corner of my eye, I would see it, and boom, it was like someone pressed a button. And I've spoken to people about it, religious people, non-religious people, and they say there's something about it you just can't explain. But yeah, so that was my unintentional pilgrimage, and I'm going back next Tuesday.
You're going back.
Taking my children to see my father who lives there.
Henry in Fort Lee, New Jersey, thank you for your story. That concludes Five Pillars Week on WNYC, five interfaith conversations based on the five pillars of Islam. We'll post all five of these conversations as a special podcast on our website and on iTunes for you to listen back to this weekend. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. Back with more in a bit. It's so bad.